It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This hour, split identities. Multiracial Americans are the fastest growing group among young people today, and demographers say that trend won't be slowing down anytime soon. Across the nation, young, multiracial, and multiethnic Americans are banding together to celebrate their shared mixed heritage. But for some people, forming a unified multicultural identity is a challenge. Lacey Schwartz was raised in a white, upper-middle-class Jewish household in upstate New York. When she was 18 years old, she discovered that she was biracial, the product of an extramarital affair. Lacey chronicles the revelation and her own search for identity in the documentary Little White Lie. Sarah Nix caught up with her.
Did you think about race much when you were growing up? Do you have any memories like that?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of memories growing up of just this idea of difference. I mean, obviously in the film, I talk about my earliest memory around that, which was being in nursery school and a fellow student asking me to show him my gums. I guess somebody had told him that if, you know, your gums are white, then you're white. If your gums are black, then you're black. At the time, more than anything, it just introduced this idea that I could be different from somebody else and they could ask me about it. I mean, I think that was really what it cemented into my mind more than anything, is this idea of difference. Not until later in my life did this concept of race connect to difference.
And it seems like that sense of difference, and particularly difference of appearance from the people around you, embedded itself somehow. You even wrote in your diary that you wished you had lighter skin. Did you talk to your parents about that too?
You know, I didn't talk about what I wished was different, I don't think, as much with my parents. I mean, I'm sure I complained about my hair. But you hear young kids saying that all the time, that they don't like the way they look. And it is deep, even if the kids don't always realize how deep it is. But, you know, the way I look at it with my parents is that it wasn't like they were at the time consciously lying to me. You know, they were working on their own denial.
And it sounds like it wasn't really until you were in high school that you started to wonder about whether they were telling you the truth or not. What changed?
You know, when I was in high school, I think that, like with anything, part of this is also about how much of like a bubble do you grow up in. When I went to high school, I was going to school in the town over, and the town next to mine was much more diverse than the town I had grown up in. And so all of a sudden, I was in a much more diverse environment where I was having increasingly different reactions to how I looked.
Can you give me an example of some of the reactions that stuck with you when you first got to high school?
Yeah, I mean, literally before I went to high school, I wasn't in school with very many people of color at all. So there wasn't any sort of collective. So to be in school where maybe I wasn't hanging out with like the black students, but they were actually congregating together. So I would walk down a hallway and there would be groups of black students who would then say things to me about how I looked and how they saw that I should identify. At that point, I still had a very firm belief that I was who I was raised to be. So I just stuck with the party line in a sense.
You know, there's a part in your film where you're talking with your old high school boyfriend. He talks about how when you guys were dating in high school, he didn't buy your parents' story.
I have such a profound memory of looking at your family pictures and being like, come on. This is like, you would have the pictures coming back from Jamaica with the braids and you get so dark. It became clear that there was this denial. I remember being so struck by it. The weight of those types of secrets, and it was a couple years before we even talked about it.
So was there a moment for you when you just knew that your parents' story wasn't holding water?
I don't think that there's like an exact moment that I can, you know, point my finger to. You know, again, I'm looking back at this in hindsight. And so at the time, I don't think it was so conscious or calculating. But I really think that I didn't want to lose my connection to my family or the comfort that my family brought me. And so, you know, I didn't really have an incentive to like rock the boat. When my parents ended up splitting up, at that point, a lot of the things were no longer there to be protected. You know, there wasn't this intact family unit. So I think that that was a real turning point in terms of me being able to be open to the idea that everything wasn't exactly what it seemed. When I went away to college, for the first time, I was kind of saw myself as an individual separate from my family.
And you found an entirely new community when you went to Georgetown, right?
Absolutely. I had a lot of diverse communities, but it was definitely the first time that I was ever really part of a Black community.
We have a great clip from the film of you talking with some friends from school about racial identity and how complicated it can get.
Is being biracial, half Black, half white, a category of being Black? Like, I think of it...
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think of it that way. Like, I identify as Black. Like, being mixed is a category of being Black. Being mixed to me is not a category of being white. For me, you know, I grew up my whole life with people constantly asking me why I looked the way I did. And so maybe I identify as being Black because I want to be a part of the Black community.
Yeah.
Being Black feels good for me.
It's such a fascinating clip. It sounds like there's a real transformation that happened while you were there.
What I have realized over the process of living my life and making this project is that, you know, the closer you get to kind of your own authenticity and being really honest about who you are, the more you're kind of clear of a lot of the baggage that you can be prone to carry around with you.
So what were some of the steps in that? You used the term coming to your own authenticity. Like, what were some of the changed ways of being that were part of that coming to your true self?
You know, one of the most pivotal pieces of awareness that I came to was when I realized I had started doing research on Black Jews in America in particular, but really around racial and ethnic diversity around Judaism. And I was really thinking about making a film and trying to figure out what was the film I wanted to make. It was a great topic, but what's the story? And I realized that I was fascinated by Black Jews because beyond obviously my own personal connection, that I had grown up in a community where being Jewish was almost synonymous with being white. But there were all of these people who were living with both Jewish identity and Black identity internally. And it just fascinated me that you had these different identities within individuals. And individuals were having to integrate themselves. And I realized that I was totally taken by this concept because that's what I was struggling to do.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because while I was watching the film, I was wondering if there were these moments of disorientation for you, you know, where you've grown up this upstate New York Jewish girl, and suddenly you're immersed in an African-American community at Georgetown. How did that feel?
Yeah, I literally would feel like I was one person in one space and another person in another space. It could be very discombobulating. By the end of that year, I just felt very disjointed, tired of taking on different roles in different spaces, and I really felt like I had to do the work to be able to allow my different selves to come together. Now, it took a lot more than having that crucial conversation with my mother. It was then, you know, 10 more years of work to actually come out of what I call the racial closet.
Well, let's talk about that conversation with your mother. When did it happen and how did it go?
After, you know, having that first year away in college, I realized that I really needed to talk to my mother about why I looked the way I did. I mean, I really hadn't had a conversation with her about it. And it was tough.
And what did she tell you?
She eventually told me that there was a very good chance my biological father was Black, that she had had an affair with a man named Rodney Parker, and that most likely he was my biological father.
Did it put your mind at ease in some way to have that question answered? I mean, I'm sure there were all sorts of complications with your father who'd raised you.
Right. So it was definitely very complicated. But yes, there was absolutely, at the same time, a modicum of relief as well, because getting answers in the end, like, it's such a cliche, but it's like the truth will set you free. I really do believe that, you know, we do need to speak our own truths and we need to know what they are and just accept them for better or worse.
Hmm. Earlier, you mentioned that you think that maybe part of the reason you didn't question the ways in which you didn't look like your parents might be because there is this pressure to conform to the people around us, to be part of the family, to not be different, and that maybe you were afraid of losing connection with your family. And I'm wondering where it stands now. I mean, do you feel like your coming into yourself has changed those relationships with your folks in a way that it wouldn't maybe if this hadn't happened?
As I got older and, you know, more confident, more sure of my own identity, I am able to know who I am and understand my connection with my family and not really feel like I have to conform in those same ways, that we can bond around the things that we have in common, but the things that are different don't have to be divisive per se. The way a lot of times I talk about it is that we want any community to be accepting and open in the sense that somebody can walk through the door and be a part of that community, but not leave other pieces of themselves behind.
Great. Well, Lacey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Of course. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Lacey Schwartz is the co-director and subject of the documentary Little White Lie. She talked with Sarah Nix. We're talking this hour about what it's like to navigate multiple cultural identities. And I want to take a minute to introduce the producer behind this hour, Raymond Tangakar. Raymond, why did you want to do a show on split identities?
So I think it was something that was a big part of my life growing up. You know, I'm the child of Pakistani and Filipino parents who were Muslim and Roman Catholic, respectively. And on top of that, I'm the child of immigrant parents. And so I was torn between the sense of obligation to honor my parents' culture, but at the same time wanting to establish my own American identity. So I think that's why the idea appeals to me.
Mm. Did you feel like your identities were in conflict ever?
You know, not all the time, but it would crop up occasionally. You know, every so often someone would ask me, so are you more Pakistani or Filipino? What are you? I would even ask myself that question. And it felt like I was choosing different sides of myself. Mm. And on top of that, you know, it felt like I was choosing between parents.
Yeah. How did that play out with family members? I mean, did family members on different sides of the family kind of push you to identify one way or the other?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was a common refrain at holiday gatherings. Everyone was interested in my soul, so to speak, you know, trying to sway me towards one side or another. You know, have you chosen a religion yet?
Were there times when you felt like you were really being disloyal to one family side or another?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, growing up, my mother's side of the family would occasionally take me to church, which is harmless. But I remember there was one year in particular where they took me to midnight mass and my parents didn't know. And so it felt like not only was I sinning, but I had this secret that I had to keep from my father. It felt like I was betraying him in some way.
How do you see yourself now?
It depends on who I'm with. If I'm with my mother's side of the family, who are Filipino, I'll probably view myself as being more Filipino. And if I'm with a Pakistani friend, I'll probably see myself as being more Pakistani. But I think generally I view myself as just an Asian American. And I'm not sure if that loose definition was my way of avoiding having to choose, but I just feel like it really sums up who I am as a person now, at least in terms of ethnicity.
Is there anything you've done to try to carve out a fresh, new identity for yourself? Have you done anything kind of symbolic to try to say, no, I'm just my own self?
Yeah, I think early on when I was younger, I don't remember the actual year, but at one point I actually kind of changed my name. At home, my parents call me Rehman or Rayman, but in public I go by Raymond. Huh. And so I think that was a way of kind of charting my own path and claiming my own identity. And who knows, maybe like in a couple of years, I'll go back to the original pronunciation.
Mm. Well, tell us about the next interview you've got lined up for us.
Well, Eric Liu is a speechwriter for President Clinton, and he recently came out with a book with the provocative title of A Chinaman's Chance. In it, he reflects on his own Chinese-American identity and how it differs across generations. And throughout the book, he also reflects on what it means to be an American today.
Okay, so let's hear Steve's interview with Eric Liu.
I was very conscious as a second-generation kid, son of immigrants, as you know, one of the relatively few Asian Americans in a largely white community in upstate New York, I had a very heightened sense of other people's expectations. I think you get very sharply tuned social antenna when you are the child of immigrants, and particularly when you are a racial minority in a predominantly white environment. And whether it was pop cultural expectations that were being set, or it was just the expectations of people around me, this idea that to the relatively rare extent that Asian and Chinese Americans ever appeared in popular imagination, popular imagery, it was in this very narrow band of types, of roles, the nerd, the evil villain, you know, the grind or the person who was doing something sneaky. And so I had this sense that there were a few stereotypes that defined how other people saw me.
And did people sort of try to fit you into those categories? Let's say the nerd or the grind?
It's less that people did and more that I feared that people did. And I think, you know, this is something that I've reflected on a lot, just, you know, a dimension of identity, which is that when you act as I did to try to defy stereotypes, so people think I'm a nerd, well, I'm going to go join the wrestling team. People think that I'm a real grind, well, I'm going to show that I can have a lot of fun too. When you live in deliberate defiance of stereotypes, you're as much a prisoner of those stereotypes as you would have been otherwise. And, you know, my own identity is for me to compose. And if, in fact, I love reading and studying, so be it. Let somebody call me a nerd. If, in fact, I actually enjoy playing the violin, which I still do, let it fit that stereotype.
So do you see this as a dual identity? I mean, you kind of have this Chinese heritage as part of you, and then you also, you know, you live in America, you grew up in America. Is it sort of hard to bring those two identities together?
I don't. I see it as a single identity in just the way, I mean, to boil it down concretely, that when I was growing up, you know, when it came to language, my parents would speak to me 80-20, 80% in Chinese, 20% in English, and I would reply in reverse ratio, 80% English, 20% Chinese. But I only can think about that or realize those ratios in hindsight, because at the time, it was all one big language. It was all one big set of norms and ideas and words and values being expressed. And I would say the same more broadly about identity. I'm American. My particular form of being American, which is informed by my Chinese heritage, is in a little way at least changing the very meaning and the content of American. You know, we live in an age right now where lots of people in America are anxious about China's rise. And I look at that and I say, I don't care. I don't care when that day comes when China's GDP surpasses that of the United States, because the U.S. retains this deep, enduring competitive advantage, which is embedded in this idea of the hybrid. And I boil it down this way. America makes Chinese Americans. China does not make American Chinese. China does not know how to, does not want to, is not interested in culturally, civilizationally, legally, in any way. They're not interested in taking in immigrants in large numbers from all over the planet, welcoming them, fusing them, integrating them into Chinese life, and empowering them to redefine Chineseness. That's just not their deal. That's not the point of life there. Well, it is the point of life here in America. Creating hybrids, welcoming people, and allowing this hybridity to, as I say, redefine Americanness and American identity itself.
Well, it's a fascinating take on, I guess, what we would call assimilation. I mean, you're really saying that when immigrants, let's say Chinese Americans, you know, become, you know, part of this country, they're not really assimilating. I mean, they're adding a new flavor, whereas I guess maybe assimilation would be a better word if you were an American who moved to China. You kind of are expected to assimilate into Chinese values, Chinese culture.
I think your point is really, really important, that there's a distinction that I want to draw between assimilation on the one hand and what I would call acculturation. What I'm describing, this hybridity, this embrace of hybridity and openness, and the fact that the base, the American base, is itself ever-changing and fluid and dynamic, that's acculturation, and we are defining and redefining the culture every day. Assimilation is essentially the expectation that we used to have in this country, you know, from the time that immigrants first started coming all the way through a good part of the 20th century and even in many ways today, which was you come to this country, you learn to be American, and by being American, what we mean is you learn to act like a white person. You learn to act and talk and walk like a WASP. That was an expectation put on you, certainly if you were non-white, but even if you were of white pigmentation, but say Jewish or Irish, well, those days are over. There's a great lag effect. There are many people in this country who don't realize it's past and who still have expectations of the assimilation of old. But I'm here to tell you that not only in my generation, but certainly in this rising, far more diverse and globally minded generation, that day of assimilation rather than acculturation has passed.
One thing I have to ask is, you were a speechwriter for President Clinton, and I don't know if there have ever been other Chinese-American presidential speechwriters. Have there been?
There have been a few. At the time that I was working for President Clinton in 1993 and 94 as a speechwriter, I had only been aware of maybe one other Asian-American speechwriter ever prior to that. Now, since my time, in fact, even during my time, there have been others. But yeah, it was, I was an exception as an Asian American speechwriter in the White House. And, you know, I'll tell you, one of the things that was most formative for me, most memorable in my time writing speeches for President Clinton, was probably the speeches that I helped write for the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And it was just so moving and powerful to me. I mean, just inherently, the subject matter is incredibly important. But to be a Generation X son of Chinese immigrants, writing speeches for the nation's first baby boom president as he was trying to honor his parents, the GI generation, in talking about a war that was essentially the last war in this country's history that everybody could agree was the, quote, good war, was just such a, you know, multi-level consequential thing for me. And it just integrated, again, back to that idea of, is my identity dual identity or is it a single identity? It integrated for me in this very strong, cohesive sense that everything adds up. This is all part of claiming and redefining America, that somebody with my background got a chance to help shape those words on that day.
Eric Liu is a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. His latest book is called A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese-American Dream. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, a psychologist unlocks the secret behind a few of our most divisive cross-cultural conflicts. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. We're talking about split multiracial and multi-ethnic identities in this hour, and writer Richard Rodriguez has written a lot on the subject. He views his so-called brown identity as a racial mixture with a long and rich heritage dating all the way back to the colonization of the Americas. When we spoke with him a few years ago, he told us why he celebrates being brown and embraces the term Hispanic.
It's a browner word, if I could use that term, because it is an English word to describe the descendants of Latin America. And it identifies me within that complexity of belonging to both sides of that Renaissance rivalry, England and Spain. By being Hispanic, I am brown. I am, again, both. And I like that predicament. It mixes up the racial conversation of America. I routinely get invited to these dreary conferences where I am seated between black and white. And the assumption is that I represent some new brown race in America. I represent no such thing. I represent the end of racial distinction in America. Because I come to the conversation prepared to say that I do not identify myself racially. By calling myself Hispanic, I identify myself culturally. To say that there are now 35, 36 million people in the United States who identify themselves as Hispanic is to say that there is in this country that has long thought of itself by reference to blood, this new emerging population that thinks of itself in reference to culture, to language, to religion, to memory, to geography. My mother watches Univision, the Spanish language network out of Miami, and she'll watch a quiz show, and there in the audience are black faces and white faces and brown faces. And she will say, pues, son Latinos, son Hispanos. She doesn't say, oh, there's a white Hispanic, there's a black Hispanic, there's a brown Hispanic. When she says they're Hispanic, she means that they participate within the culture of this language and of Univision, of this memory of Latin America that they participate in. That's a very revolutionary thing in the United States. One of the things I'm struck with is that so many of the young people around me in San Francisco as I was writing have begun to experiment with color, with blue hair and green hair. And there was the King of Brown. I called Michael Jackson the King of Brown. on his rock video, Morphine into All the Faces of the Earth. This new experiment with identity, it seems to me, that's very much of this brown moment. There's all this confusion right now in America, and I say good. The more confusion, the better. I'm tired of this black and white conversation.
Richard Rodriguez is the author of Brown, The Last Discovery of America, and his latest book is called Darling, a Spiritual Autobiography. This hour, we've been talking about what it's like to navigate different cultural identities when you're not just black or white, Asian or American, when explaining who you are requires multiple hyphens. And when you think about it, that's something we all face. I mean, I'm white, but I'm also an Easterner transplanted to the Midwest. I'm a woman working in a formerly male profession, a mom, and a career woman. Social scientist Elena Connor believes we all navigate split identities and culture clashes, and not just along racial or ethnic lines. She finds many cultural conflicts boil down to two competing types of selves.
Yeah, in our book, Clash, we show that many of the world's fiercest cultural conflicts actually stem from the same root cause, which is the clash of independence versus interdependence. All of us have two selves. Our independent self wants to be separate, unique, and in control, but our interdependent self wants to be connected, similar, and cooperative. Depending on your unique mix of cultural backgrounds, you probably tend to use one self more than the other. Intentions flare when people using their independent self interact with people using their interdependent self.
So what you're talking about is the difference between seeing yourself as a lone actor in the world as opposed to seeing yourself as part of a web of connected relationships?
That's right. And if you look across cultures, if you look across cultural conflicts, you see that many of them fall out pretty cleanly across this independent and interdependent divide. So, for example, in our book, we cover eight conflicts. We cover East versus West, Global North versus Global South, men versus women, whites versus people of color, rich versus poor, the coast versus the heartland, religious conservatives versus religious liberals, and businesses versus nonprofits and governments.
That's a huge number of different kinds of cultural conflicts. And you're saying that you think all of them at heart are really conflicts between interdependence and independence?
That's right. And let me just give an example that I think a lot of people can relate to, and that is the example of men versus women. So I feel the clash of independence and interdependence every time I have to negotiate my salary. I know how to negotiate for a good salary. I've done it several times now in my career. And I know that you're supposed to crow to the rafters about your individual contributions and your unique talents and strengths. But when I'm in this negotiation process, I'm also keenly aware of how much my coworkers have contributed to my successes. I'm also very worried that my boss will think that I am arrogant if I sit there and talk about how awesome I am. So these are very interdependent concerns. And research shows, many hundreds of studies show, that women tend to be more in touch with their interdependent self. And so in these negotiation situations, I tend to ask for less than I know I'm worth, and I don't haggle as hard as I know I can. And I am not alone. Research shows that interdependent concerns compel many women to ask for less and walk away from negotiations sooner. Research also shows that women are actually pretty wise to do this, because when women are seen as too independent, they face more discrimination and backlash than when they are seen as interdependent.
Well, that's one example. Another example has to do with class and ethnicity. I'm curious, when did you personally begin to notice these two different value systems yourself?
I was raised by a single mother in a working class neighborhood of Memphis, Tennessee. And I have an older brother. And so I think I became very aware just of gender and different ways of being a self quite young. I was pretty observant that my brother was treated differently from me and was expected to do things that I was not expected to do. And these expectations were along these independent, interdependent lines. But I really felt the clash of class cultures when I went away to college. So I went to Yale University in Connecticut, where I was suddenly surrounded by very wealthy classmates who had already developed all these unique ideas and peculiar tastes, plus the confidence to share them. They were telling me about their ideas all the time. So I also had ideas, but I had been taught that it's better to sit silently and appear stupid than to open your mouth and remove all doubt. This was actually a sign my grandmother gave me to hang in my dorm room. And so I spent my first several years of college in mystified silence, worried that the admissions office had made a mistake. Later, as a cultural psychologist, I understood that my struggles in college arose because the interdependent cultures I grew up in clashed with the independent culture of my college. And our lab at Stanford now has several studies showing that this clash of independence and interdependence holds back many talented working class kids who beat the odds and get into good colleges.
I'm curious, how do you see this difference playing out in terms of racial and ethnic divides, you know, between people of color and white Americans? I mean, we're talking just weeks after the protests in Ferguson and other places around the country, which have laid bare some really painful differences between black and white America. Does your concept of independence versus interdependence shed any particular light on what's been going on?
Yes. I mean, I think a very interesting aspect of race relations in the U.S. is European Americans, people of European heritage, think that race doesn't matter, whereas people of color are very aware that race matters very much, and it might be the most important factor that's shaping their life outcomes. So let me just give an example. So as I said, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and that's where the National Civil Rights Museum is located. And when I'm home, I like to visit the museum and take any out-of-town guests there. But many of my white friends back home will ask, why do we even have to have that museum? It just makes people feel bad. Racism is no longer a problem. We have a black president, for goodness sake. So during this culture clash, I can see that my white friends are using their independent selves. They think that they are unique and in control and neither hindered nor helped by their race, history, or status. Meanwhile, my black friends tend to use their interdependent selves, which recognize that people are very much influenced by their race, history, and status. And hundreds of scientific studies actually support my black friends' supposition that race, history, and status are very important. So this idea that race doesn't matter, or we need to rise above race, or, you know, we're all just neutral, colorblind human beings, is a very independent idea. And it's an idea that tends to be endorsed by people of European heritage. And the problem, of course, with that colorblind ideology is that it can blind white Americans to the very real effects of race and racism for people of color.
So are you saying that having a more interdependent identity is, for minorities, a way of coping with discrimination?
Yes, certainly interdependence can be seen as a reaction to discrimination. You know, if you see me through the lens of race, I'm going to also see myself through the lens of race and begin to be constructed through your eyes as a person who is black first and foremost and a person second, if at all. But there's a very positive side to the interdependence that people of color have as well, and that is our cultures are and can be a source of great pride and a source of strength. In some studies, if you ask people to describe themselves, people of color are much more likely to spontaneously mention their race or ethnicity than are white people. And so being a person of color is very central to people's identities. And also it can be a source of strength when you're facing discrimination and oppression. You can bind together around this shared identity and try to make change in a world that doesn't actually allow you to operate using your independent self.
So we've been talking about how this tension between independence and interdependence is involved in a whole variety of cultural conflicts, you know, not just racial and ethnic, but also regional, gender, religious, political. What do we do about it?
Just knowing that you have two selves as opposed to just one is unto itself an 100% increase in your psychological resources. Many people think, you know, I am who I am no matter where I am. But we're trying to communicate that people do have these two different sides to themselves to be deployed in different situations. We are all multicultural. We all have at least two selves. There are times and situations when all of us are on the side of being the more interdependent and also less powerful person in a situation who is being misunderstood to our own detriment. As the world gets smaller, each of us will have to become more skilled at using both independence and interdependence to heal these cultural conflicts. And we will need to do that as the problems we face as a species become much larger than any one group of people can actually tackle. So climate problems, economic problems, even problems with natural resources, problems with food supplies, no one group can actually tackle that problem alone. We're going to have to share our strengths. It's time that we learn how to do that.
Elena Connor is the executive director of the Stanford Center for Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions. And she's the co-author of Clash, How to Thrive in a Multicultural World. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, writer Steve Almond will tell us what to read next. And with mounting concerns over the country's student loan debt, we'll take a closer look at public higher education in the U.S. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Steve Almond, and the book I want you to read as soon as... Actually, you could actually be reading it while I'm talking to you. It's that good, and I'm that boring. It's a novel called Stoner. It was given to me many years ago by a friend of mine, and I can tell you that I thought it was about something very different from what it actually turns out to be about. The book is not actually about any kind of drug-fueled exploits. It is maybe the quietest and most restrained book I've ever read. It's about a man named William Stoner, and the first couple of paragraphs essentially announced to the reader that he was an academic, studied medieval literature, and he taught for many years at the same school. He did not go off to World War I and become a war hero. He was not involved in any major intrigue. He's mostly a forgotten figure. He's a forgotten figure to his colleagues and his students. They don't think about him at all. It's the strangest opening to a novel I've ever experienced, and it's also completely hypnotic. What the book is about is one man's life, and it really represents those of us who are really, which is most of us, who are going to be forgotten by history. And the message it sends is that if you pay really careful attention to any life, it is absolutely gripping. And that's the kind of book that Stoner is. William Stoner suffers through a terrible marriage. He has a beautiful, amazing, rescuing love affair. He engages in an absolutely crazy, silly, passive-aggressive academic feud that really ruins his life for a number of years. And he grapples with trying to be a good parent. And all that Stoner is really grabs him at the crucial moments in his life when he's having to make huge decisions that are going to change the course of his life and that deeply move him inside, and really slows down during those moments. We see all the internal turmoil that it is to be a human being, even a human being who's completely forgotten by history and not even that well regarded by his colleagues. And it's a really profound message, because I think in this era especially, we tend to think that what makes something exciting is how famous you are, how much attention you're able to win from the world. That's what social media is all about. That's what so much of the media is about. How much attention can we suck from the world? Stoner is suggesting just the opposite, that what makes our lives blessed and holy and worth living is the attention that we pay to our own lives and to those moments in our lives that are the most exciting, exalted, terrifying, and beautiful. It's an amazing novel.
Steve Almond recommends Stoner by John Williams. And you'll find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. This week we're thinking about college. Student loan debt now tops $1 trillion, and college is not getting any cheaper anytime soon. Private colleges and universities have always been expensive, so maybe that's not such a surprise. But these days, tuition is on the rise at what was supposed to be the affordable alternative, public universities. So what are kids and families supposed to do if they can't even afford in-state tuition? Chris Newfield is an English professor at one of the biggest state systems, the University of California, and he says he's worried, really worried, about the decline of public higher education. He told Steve Paulson why.
I'm a second-generation college person. My parents were really the first and the only people in their families in California to get out of high school and continue. And I saw the transformative effect that basically this free place that was also open access, you know, that didn't require being in the top 1 or the top 5 or even 10% of academic performance to get in and get a good education. I saw what it did to their lives and to my life. So I became quite interested in shoring up this system, the public system, that's really the only thing that has the size and the capability to have a real impact on society.
And in many ways, the public university, it has been one of the great success stories of recent American history, right?
Well, I don't know what we do better, actually, in the United States. In terms of social development, in terms of the advancement of creative capabilities, human capabilities, this is really the best thing we have going.
So what's happened? I mean, well, why have things changed in the last couple of decades?
Part of it is that the middle class is not doing as well economically. It doesn't feel like it has enough money to fund these kinds of institutions at a high level through taxes. Part of it is just the tax revolt. There was a third issue, which is kind of retroactively people decided that higher ed is a private good.
Oh, as a private good. In other words, everyone should have access to
it. Right. Well,
if you
have it, you should pay for it because it's really just about your salary. And that's completely wrong in terms of the social impact of higher ed. Higher ed is like public health. You know, it benefits the whole society. And if you don't have it, people get sick. But that was defined in this other way as just something that benefited you. So why should I pay for you? It's kind of the spirit of the country that we've been having to deal with over the last 30 years or so. But it's affected the quality of K-12. It's affected higher education, it's affected public health, it's affected transportation. There's a whole range of public services that have been damaged by this idea.
So is the basic problem here that state governments are less willing to pay for their universities?
Yes.
And taxpayers are not willing to pay as much, and so tuition keeps rising?
Yes. But there's another piece of this that is something that I focus on in my books, and that is the legislators were not told clearly by university administrators what was going to be lost if they reduced public funds and forced private funding in through tuition in particular. You can't do the same kind of things for the same broad range of people with private money that you can do with public money. It's just so it won't have as big a social impact. We also were able to raise tuition. And so if you're a legislator, it's understandable that if you're faced with choices between, you know, funding hospice care for indigent elder people and, on the other hand, keeping tuition down for really healthy, smart 18-year-olds, you're going to fund the first and not the second. And so we were, you know, in terms of the state's obligation to fund Medicare and Medicaid and programs that weren't around in the 60s, there were less pleasant choices that legislators had to make, and universities weren't there pushing them in the right direction, saying, look, we understand your problem, but we can't just raise tuition and think that we're going to have to do the same, the good thing for the state that we've been doing before.
But isn't financial aid still available for those truly in need?
No.
No?
I mean, it's available, and you have to fill out 1 million forms to get it. There's this complicated, difficult process. It does not cover, except for the lowest cost places like community colleges, it does not cover cost of attendance for lower income people. So this is a myth that I think has been very corrosive. If you look at the amount that people borrow by income, you discover that students that come from families that make less than $30,000 a year borrow as much on average in the aggregate over 4 years as do students who come from families that make over $70,000.
Really? I'm
yeah.
I'm shocked by that.
Well, the reason is that although very often their tuition is paid in full, they can get Pell Grants, they can get state aid, they still have to live, they still have to support themselves, they have to buy books, clothes, et cetera. So if you look at not just tuition, but if you look at the total cost of attendance, as it's called, what you find is that there's a gap between what's even low-income students get in financial aid and what they have to pay out every year that they have to borrow to fill. The other thing that this does is it makes students who are risk-averse and low-income people are generally less willing to incur debt because they can't imagine paying it back as easily as higher-income people. It means that they're more likely to stop before they get their degree. And that's kind of a national disaster. You know, we have 40-50% of people who start college not finishing.
And then the other piece of this is the amount of student debt keeps rising.
The famous number was a couple of years ago when it passed total credit card debt, revolving credit. It's over a trillion. It's still climbing. It's, what is it, 1.2? I have a colleague that has a student debt clock on his website. And it just – it's like the national debt, only worse.
There must be a limit to how much student debt people can have, right? I mean, it just sort of is unsustainable.
It is unsustainable, but the way that people manage is by quitting school or by – there's another thing that students do, which is they go to a cheaper school that isn't necessarily as good. It's called undermatching, where a low-income, very high-performing student won't go to Madison, will go to community college. And then that'll cost them money even just to finish 2 years of community college, and they may stop there instead of getting a BA from this campus.
So we've been talking about the money problems, the problem of paying for college. What about the quality of education? Any indication that that's also going down?
I mean, the faculty work week, a tenured faculty is somewhere between 60 and 70 hours a week. And that's actually gotten a little bit longer, at least in my anecdotal experience, because the way that we've had to manage budget cuts is by having larger classes, by converting labor-intensive activities like grading every calculus problem or reading through 4 essays plus 1 draft a term to shortcuts, either converting some essays to exams, converting some written exams to Scantron-type multiple-choice exams. You know, there's a kind of a slow corrosive effect in not giving students as much feedback as they need in order to develop their whole potential. So that's been a problem. The other thing is, I mean, the great thing about the discussion about online education in the last couple of years is not that it's going to save a lot of money. It's not. But that it has gotten us thinking more about teaching and whether we're doing it as completely and as comprehensively as we want to.
Right. I mean, there's this huge question of, is online education as good as classroom education, you know, with the face-to-face interaction you have with the teacher?
Well, the purely online is not as good. The answer is pretty clearly no. Hybrids are as good in many cases when you do them right. And if you do them right, they cost as much money. And in some cases, more money is just hiring an actual person to do the teaching. So that's a whole long discussion. But what it has done is it's put front and center on the agenda for faculty sort of active learning. How can we get students more involved in their learning? And how can we develop what Martha Nussbaum calls creative capabilities and not just kind of content mastery that people don't really know how to engage with and really use when they graduate? Online can help with that. But the thing that really helps is small scale, face-to-face, immediate feedback that's customized for each individual student. And that is something that high-end schools can still deliver. It's something that public universities are having a harder time getting to. My concern is that we're going to create a very disparate 2-, 3-, 4-tier higher education system where we have an aristocracy that goes to Ivy League and Ivy League type schools. And then we have equally fantastic students that are just not going to get the same opportunities and will be slotted into a lower level in the economy and society.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like another thing that's happened is there's a lot more private money coming into the university. And I don't just mean students paying tuition. I mean, there is sort of this courting of businesses, of the corporate world. And I mean, for obvious reasons, as we've just been talking, I mean, you know, there's a desperate need for more money. I guess I'm wondering if there's a problem with this as well.
Yeah, well, there's a big debate about this. I know that faculty are really trying to stay arm's length from what the funder wants. So you can't just buy research. You can't just buy research results. But there have been scandals over the years with clinical trials that are sponsored by companies whose drug is being tested. And even when there are double-blind procedures, you get more positive results than if they don't fund it. And this is starting to diffuse itself through all disciplines because all disciplines are short of money now. There's a term that the outgoing executive vice chancellor at Berkeley used called unit-level entrepreneurialism. And what it refers to is every division and every department and every professor and even every staff person having to spend some part of their time thinking about fundraising. And, you know, there's nothing inherently evil about that. It's just that it's another job. So you can't teach. You can't redo your slides for today if you are also hustling for money. It's cheaper for the overall educational system to directly fund free universities. It actually would be less expensive to pay all that tuition money to cover it with state money and not have any students take out loans that they have to then pay back for 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Why? Why would that be more efficient?
Well, because so much money is taken out of the educational system and sent into the banking system. What is it, 25 cents, 30 cents on the loan dollar doesn't actually go to the university in the form of tuition. It goes to interest and to fees and to transactional costs of various kinds. A colleague of mine named Bob Samuels has written a book about this that argues that public universities should be completely free.
As they are in many European countries,
yes,
right?
But on the grounds, not only ethical grounds, that it's wrong to burden a younger generation in a way that we didn't burden ourselves, but just on pragmatic monetary grounds, that it's cheaper for society in the same way that single-payer healthcare is.
So is this your solution? I mean, if you could, you know, if you were czar of higher education in the United States, make all public universities free?
Yes, it is now. You know, I spent 10 years doing planning and budget for the Academic Senate at UC, and I felt like I really had to work with the arguments that were on the table. And so I didn't ever say that for years and years. And now I think we need to do something much more radical. We can't just keep band-aiding it and raising, you know, 5% from the state and another 3.5% from students this year and then flip it around next year. It's just not working. We've been nickel and diming people into enormous tuition costs and debt for 30 years, and we need to go in a different direction.
Christopher Newfield teaches literature and American studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. His latest book is called Unmaking the Public University, the 40-year assault on the middle class. And that's it for this hour. But if you like what you heard, why not subscribe to our podcast? Look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And while you're there, it'd be great if you could leave us a review. That really helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tangakar produced today's show. With help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely, our theme music is from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.